Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome to the Stock Club podcast. I'm James, and with me this week is my Wall Street co-founder and chief investor, Emmett Savage, and our head analyst, Rory Caron. Today, we're talking about GameStop, AMC, and why we can expect more of the madness we saw last week, why Twitter should become a subscription business, and the one stock on the S&P 500 that we'd short if we had to. So Rory, a couple of weeks ago you asked for listeners in countries where we had only one listener to reach out to us and say hello. Well, a few days ago, James from Mauritania on the West African coast reached out to us via a colleague here in my Wall Street to say hello. So hello, James. I hope the weather's a bit better over there than it is here in Dublin.
Wow, Mauritania.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that.
That's a great one. Yeah.
It's a good one. So I took the time for this podcast to go through the list of other countries where we have only one listener. So I'm going to read out the list now. And if you are that listener, that country, reach out and get in touch. And I don't know. I don't think we've anything to send you, but we'll say hello. So we have Bosnia and Herzegovina, Bangladesh, the Bahamas, Belize, Dominican Republic, Ghana, Cambodia, Sri Lanka, Morocco, Niger, Papua New Guinea, El Salvador, the minor outlying islands of the United States, which I'm not sure what that is exactly, and the Virgin Islands. So if you are the single listener in any of those countries, reach out and say hello.
The most amazing country there, sorry, is Bangladesh, because that's like one of the most populated countries in the world. So it's amazing that we've penetrated the market, but only got one person.
It's only up from here, Rory. It's only up. Massive market opportunity. Emma, do you think we could get my Wall Street to stretch for a fact-finding mission to the Virgin Islands? Or
yeah, I'm thinking Necker Island. I saw a documentary about it and its inhabitants, and I thought, yeah, I could live like that.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll get back to you on that then. So in the last episode of Stock Club, as you all might remember, I asked both of you to pitch me a red hot risky contrarian stock pitch with a disclaimer that it was just for a bit of fun. Emmett, you pitched AMC, which was about $3.50 at the time, I think, or maybe less. I think it was actually just under $3. Between that episode going live and the following Wednesday, the stock price had jumped well over fivefold to hit a high of almost $20. So I suppose the real question is, have you any more stock tips for us?
Are you going to tell us your Reddit username? Come
on. Hashtag pump and dump. No, I actually, my crystal ball was really working well that day.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I was totally surprised. But I have to say, my whole investment thesis for AMC had nothing to do with the events that prevailed. I was actually, I was just happy that AMC had found a new line of credit, that vaccines were being rolled out. I figured we'd all get back to the cinema by this summer. And sure enough, other matters were bubbling up on Reddit.
Yeah, it was really a case of being right, but for all the wrong reasons.
Oh, entirely.
Just trying to you dig yourself out of SEC investigation, because it's not going to work.
Look, I'm not. Let me give you an example. I'm not one for golf. I'm not a huge fan, but I've played about 5 rounds of golf in my life, and each one I enjoyed less. But in one particular round of golf, I had a hole in one. I hit the ball and went straight in. That's what happened with AMC. I was like, by Wednesday, I thought, yes, I think I might just build a career off this crystal ball. But sure enough, it really was a short squeeze. Now, granted, it's fallen all the way back to like 2 or 3-fold where I called it.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'll take it. Yeah, it was good.
Absolutely. Well, as many of our listeners surely know by now, AMC was one of a handful of stocks that was caught up in what I suppose you could say was one of the most bizarre market events that I've personally ever seen. Anyway, driven by the now infamous Wall Street Bets subreddit, a buying frenzy of stock on beaten down companies like GameStop, AMC, COS and BlackBerry triggered the mother of all short squeezes last week, sending shares in GameStop particularly skyrocketing and even toppling a hedge fund. Lads, there's obviously a lot of stuff we can talk about here, but I want to come to you first, Emmett, as you're the most experienced investor here. Have you ever seen anything happen like this before, or have you ever seen a market like we experienced last week?
No, there are parallels, but no, I've never seen anything with the same kind of orchestration as we saw in the last week. I mean, about 50 or 60 years ago, Merrill Lynch, the big stockbroker in the US, became known as the Thundering Herd, which I think I might have even informed their logo, which is a bull. And what they had was a network of investment advisors and clients, tens of thousands of investment advisors, who, and it was their recommendation would actually move the markets. So this army of Merrill Lynch advisors would advise their clients would take an action and the market would move. And this very much reminded me, or came back to me when I saw the events of the last week. You could say that the Reddit Brigade was 2021's Thundering Herd. Yeah. And as you said, like at the center of the frenzy of activity was GameStop. And, you know, it is a real, you know, 20th century bricks and mortar business model. You know, in April of last year, it was like $2 and change. It was like $2.50 a share. And last week hit $483 a share. And actually, another way of looking at it, sorry, just another one I just found, was that last year, GameStop traded around 5 million shares a day. Yeah. But last Tuesday, its volume rose to 178 million shares, which is twice the total shares in issuance traded on a single day. So I can safely say I have never even heard of such a thing. I didn't think that the systems that exist could cope with such demand. So the entire number of shares out in circulation changed hands 2x in one day. And that to me is unquestionably a first. And maybe some of our listeners can point at something similar. But frankly, the last week is one of the most unprecedented moments. And as these things generally are, it popped up when we least expected it.
Absolutely. Rory, I think one of the things last week really showed me was the difference between the idea of trading stock and the idea of investing in stock. What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, I think there's multiple ways to look at this story, and probably the worst way, I think, is to be dismissive of it and somehow imply that the people involved are, you know, foolish in some way, or that they were like totally misguided. I'll point out that on Monday, the New York Times Daily did a podcast on this, and the first person they had on to speak wasn't the business editor, or wasn't anyone from the world of finance, but it was Taylor Lorenz, who covers internet culture. So the New York Times took a decision that this story was more about internet culture than it was about finance, and I think there's a good argument to be made for that. You could even go like one step further, I suppose, and say it's a story about the times we live in and the tensions that exist out there at the moment. Like, looking at Wall Street Bets is kind of where this kind of all originated from. Its subject is finance, but the driving forces of that subreddit are so varied. Like, there's a desire to make money, not just like what we talk about, a desire to, you know, retire wealthy, but like to make I've got five yachts kind of money and to make it like tomorrow, you know. But there's also this desire to kind of create memes and to kind of spark movements, to utilize the collective to kind of make change, you know, harness the internet for what it was supposed to be for in the first place. And that can oftentimes be kind of cloaked, I suppose, in sort of machismo, even kind of toxic masculinity to a point. But like, make no mistake, the people who pull this off, the ones who made the serious money anyway, are by no means foolish. They saw a flaw in the system and exploited it. And of course, that's what people on Wall Street do every day. That's what people working in hedge funds do every day. So now there's another side to this, which is people who tried to kind of turn it into this kind of revolutionary movement. And then you kind of have to look like who benefits there. Do they really believe that they're, you know, trying to overthrow a corrupt financial system, or are they perpetrating one of the oldest cons in the book, which is convince people who don't know much better that they're in on it, you know, that they're in on the con themselves, and that they're not the ones being manipulated, that some powerful kind of faceless entity is that's been holding people down for centuries is the one that's going to take it in the neck. And you can totally see why so many people were happy to indulge in this idea. You know, we live in a world of extreme inequality, totally heightened by social media. There's people out there of more money than they could spend in 100 lifetimes. Yeah. And there's those who struggle every day to pay their health bills. And so, you know, and then top on that, this like real distrust that emerged, you know, that we're living in this post-truth world. You know, all I could think about last week was that Orwell line, 2 + 2 = 5, which is just such a famous, powerful line, because it encapsulates everything about truth. You know, once 2 + 2 = 5, it can equal anything.
Yeah.
It doesn't. Once you've crossed that Rubicon, there's no going back. And I think that, you know, the Reddit users who started this will claim Wall Street crossed that line a long time ago. Like, who are they to get to decide what a company is worth? Why, you know, they talk a lot about things like intrinsic value and fair value and then slap a multiple on it that fluctuates day by day. So one day a company is worth $50 billion, the next day it's worth $60 billion. And that's just because some group of people in a Wall Street bank decided that's what it was worth. You know, that's the attitude they have. And, you know, Scott Galloway made a point that the wealth of people under the age of 40 as percentage of total wealth has gone from 19% to 9% in the last 30 years. Like, that's a huge change in society and the structure of how we live. And I think you take all these elements, you bring them together, and they were all kind of fighting at some point last week over control of this narrative, over control of where this whole thing was going. And on top of that, you had some people who, I think, know better, who were throwing fuel on the flames. It was a real hot mess, to be honest with you. And,
you've mentioned a lot of different kind of actors and different influences there, and it kind of struck me because a lot of the commentary I'd been reading was really pitching it as a David versus Goliath battle, you know, the individual retail investor versus, you know, the faceless hedge fund on Wall Street. I don't think it is as simple as that, and I'd like to get your perspective. You know, a lot of it, you know, there was revolutionary talk, and I saw one article that compared it to the French Revolution, which I don't know if I exactly agree with, but there was a sense as well, I thought, of kind of like nihilism, and people weren't obviously wanted to make money, but they were also just doing it because they could.
You have to give them credit. They stormed the castle. Yeah. there's absolutely no doubt they stormed the castle. Now, in every revolution, there's bad actors who then come in and, you know, try to profiteer off the back of that. And I think there's those elements of that as well. From our point of view, from what we do, we were looking at it going like, well, this has nothing to do with investing, does it?
Yeah.
It just doesn't. Like, there's no investing angle to this. It's there's trading angle to it, there's a societal element to it, there's the whole social media buzz and you know, Robin Hood and all these various elements are coming in, but it really had nothing to do with what we do on a day-to-day basis. We just try and kind of analyze great companies for the next 5 to 10 years. So this is as far as I think we should be kind of talking about it in a much more kind of abstract
absolutely
way.
And let's get back to that point, Emmett. You know, when you see the craziness of last week, you, as a long-term investor, you feel a lot of emotions. You feel like maybe you're missing out on something. You feel like maybe worried about the positions you currently have. As a long-term investor, when you see such kind of wild and volatile day trading, how are you supposed to respond? What approach should you take?
You know, the grown-up approach is to stand back and let it play out and watch it. And, you know, it's so easy to get drawn into it because it is a biological need to have a flutter. And Jason Zweig kind of documented this in his book, I think it's Your Money and Your Brain, where he said you have to acknowledge at a biological level there's a human need to get the rush of a bet. And, you know, so what's actually happening now, I'm not speaking as a doctor, but I am speaking as a, you know, as a stock investor, that there is this kind of this addictive quality. You've bought a share and suddenly it's double, and or you've missed it. Should I buy now and hopefully get it double again? And then if you're in, there's regret that you didn't invest more. And should I sell now? There's so many conversations happening in your head that are a mix between regret and greed and excitement and possibly, and in a lot of cases, probably the feeling of loss when you've gotten in a bit late and it's fallen over the other side of the cliff. And really, you don't want to be doing that with your investments. Yes, if you want to participate in that market, go to your local bookies, or is that what they're called in America? Well, go to your local bookmaker, to your betting shop, and that's where you should be appealing to that need if you feel it prevails in your mind in a controlled, you know, environment, and only bet what you can afford to lose, etc. But like, it shouldn't be done on the stock market.
Can I pitch a side podcast where Emmett does talk like a doctor? Think about that as a new show that we do.
Can you get sued for medical malpractice if you're not a doctor? Maybe we'll get our legal team on that first. Just to finish up on this point then, Roy, I want to come back to you and I want to ask what you think the long-term effects of an event like this is going to be. You know, this is the first time, as Emmett mentioned, we've seen this kind of like collective action, for want of a better term, you know, in terms of making these trades. fueled by internet communities and low cost brokerages and all the kind of the things we're enjoying in 2021. Do you think this is something we'll see continue or more, or was this just a one-off event?
I definitely don't think it was a one-off event. You know, I was listening back to the podcast before we started recording this. I listened back to our previous podcast when we were talking about kind of TikTok and the people who are investing on TikTok. And part of me was kind of thinking, like, you know, who are we to say that a generation can't use the medium of their choice to talk about things like investing? You know, that's so in some ways it's like, well, this is going to be part of the future. This is how people communicate now. And I don't know, like, long-term effects are hard to tell when I don't think it's over yet. This, you know, we're recording on Wednesday. The things might have changed rapidly by the time Friday comes along.
Yeah.
I think for hedge funds, they're definitely going to take a lot less risk. They're not going to expose themselves to something like that happening again when you see the likes of Malvern Capital losing billions of dollars, and like actual billions of dollars over the course of a couple of days. But I think there'll be positives and negatives that come out for it. I think it's bred a lot of distrust in the system, particularly in the brokerages like Robinhood.
Yeah. But that distrust is unfortunate as well, because, you know, there's a lot of people who probably this was their first experience of the markets, and they might be completely disillusioned with the notion of investing altogether now.
Yeah, that's definitely a possibility. I think the people who have bought at the highs could end up losing an awful lot of money, and that'll breed a lot of distrust and a lot of anger that doesn't need to be there at the moment. There's already enough of that out there in the world. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know what the actual long-term effects of it are going to be. I think there definitely is. I think we will look back on this moment in 5-10 years and remember it. It's not something that's just going to fade into obscurity.
Yeah.
What do you think, Amit?
Yeah, actually, it's quite kind of interesting. Our colleague John Tyrrell was on the phone on Sunday to the CEO of a giant stockbroker in the US, whose name I'll withhold because neither John nor that CEO were speaking on behalf of a podcast. And the CEO in question of the company that I'm quite certain all of our listeners would know was sympathetic towards Robinhood. He was of the mind that this was a force beyond anything that they could have ever considered, that wasn't of their doing. And I was quite surprised, actually. John debriefed me on how that chat went. And I think brokers realized that this force that they observed was bigger than the system. And yeah, that is one of the many elements, I think, that kind of make it the most unique situation. You know, brokers themselves, seasoned brokers and owners and founders of brokerage firms have never seen the likes and never anticipated such a movement and didn't dimension their systems for this kind of surge.
Yeah, I mean, we're coming off the end of, remember, 40 years of deregulation and toothless federal agencies that don't take action when they see weaknesses in the system. And it's, you know, this should be a wake-up call, at least to those in power, to say, here, we need to shore up the systems and start putting some integrity back into these markets, because people are losing faith in them. And this is just one of a display of that.
Absolutely. Let's move from one social media site to another then, and Twitter. Last week, Twitter announced that it was acquiring a Dutch startup called Revue for an undisclosed sum. Revue is a service that allows publishers to monetize newsletters similar to Substack, and is already providing services for major content creators like Vox Media. This acquisition seemed to stoke rumors again of something that many people have talked about for a long time, which is that Twitter should become a subscription service. Emmett, you're an avid Twitter user. What do you think? Should Twitter go down the subscription path?
I think they should, yeah. And I'll tell you why. I'm speaking as a stock investor here and not necessarily an end user, which of course I am.
Yeah.
But Twitter has 187 million daily active users. It has a highly engaged audience. But when we look at it as an investment, on the day of Twitter's IPO, about 7 or 8 years ago, shares closed on the day at $45 or thereabouts. Whereas a couple of days ago, on January 28th, they closed at $51.57.
Wow.
So they've barely increased at all. The shares have, in essence, they've been flat since IPO. Now, of course, the in-between bit is a different story, but they've barely increased like a compounded 1-2% per year since they floated. So from an investment perspective, it's been very lackluster. And there's been moments where Twitter is center stage and all spotlight, all eyes of the world are on Twitter. Yeah. And most notably when President Trump was in office and was using it as his main platform for conversation. But if you look at the other social networks in the same intervening period since Twitter IPO'd, they've performed extraordinarily well. But you mentioned Scott Galloway there earlier, James, and I read a quote from Scott in was it I think it's New Yorker magazine. The quote is as follows: "The company should recognize that many people and organizations derive enormous value from Twitter at little or no cost. My 345,000 follower account is an important tool in my professional life and a window into the communities I care about. I'd pay a subscription fee if Twitter thought to ask for it, and I believe Kim Kardashian, with nearly 69 million followers, would pay more." Yeah. And that's a very valid point. You know, if you've earned an audience through Twitter and they're engaged and it is your mouthpiece to the world, as it was indeed for President Trump, these people generally can afford to pay for that. So I think that that wouldn't be a bad application and a bad idea for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Rory, like as Emmett pointed out, if the last 4 years of the US presidential administration were basically run on this platform and they haven't made it work from a business point of view yet, what other option do Twitter have other than to go down a different route to make money?
Yeah, funny enough, Emily, I read the exact same article. I thought it was really good. Yeah, look, Twitter's advertising business has not panned out. Yeah. The Facebook and Google own the digital advertising space. And they have for years. That doesn't mean that no other company can make money in the space. Like, but you have to differentiate yourself somehow. Pinterest is a perfect example of a company that manages to collect digital advertising revenue by distinguishing itself as different yeah. from what you see on things like Facebook and Twitter. So it's a place where people come together over shared interests and shared hobbies. Twitter is the way where people go to Twitter at the moment is for aggression. Yeah. That's, you know, it's the currency of social media is getting people hyped up, getting people angry, sowing divide between people. And, you know, in that article, I know Emma that he wrote, at the moment, Twitter's annualized advertising revenue is about $3.2 billion. To entirely replace that revenue through subscription fees alone, Twitter would just need 15% of its users to pay an average of $10 a yeah. month. So like, the economics make complete sense. And if Twitter wants to hold itself as, you know, higher up than Facebook, which I think it does. They never come out and blatantly say it, yeah. but I definitely think Jack Dorsey does see Twitter as a purer space. Then this is the exact kind of thing that they should do. They should be innovating to try and make it a better platform. Yeah. A subscription model brings up huge amounts of opportunities for things that they could do to clean it up and get rid of the trolls and get rid of the divisions that are caused on it, where people are just going on there to get this dopamine hit yeah. of rage every day. You know, think about the verified accounts on Twitter. That was originally intended for, you know, people of celebrity, for example, to ensure that that they weren't being impersonated by other people's online. Why not repurpose that idea and let everyone who wants to be verified be verified? Mm. Like, and people who want to remain anonymous can, I suppose, if they want, but it gives you so much greater control of how you want to react to interact on the platform. Yeah. You could do some simple things like only verified people can respond to this, or I only want to see tweets from verified people. You know, super simple things like that could totally give people more control over the platform that they're on. And I suppose the counter argument is that you'll end up with echo chambers, but we're already in echo chambers. Yeah. You know, that's what's happening already because the algorithm's making it yeah. that way. So I definitely think a subscription model would work great for Twitter. In, you know, true to form, they announced an idea off it, everyone went, great idea, and then they did absolutely nothing for the next 6 months. Yeah. So they are the slowest innovating company in the world, I think, at the moment. And I hope they just get their act together and just even test it. Just do a test and see if it works, because yeah. I think it will. I really do think it will.
Well, in fairness, Jack Dorsey is splitting his time between Twitter and growing a beard. But with this acquisition of Review, how do you think, you know, a newsletter subscription, which has grown in popularity, you know, Substack is one of the most highly valued private companies recently. How would a tool like this help Twitter move towards subscription, do you think?
Well, there's for decades been this tension between the people who create content and the people who distribute content. You can see this all over the place. You look at studios versus Netflix, content, like journalists versus editors, yeah, to start with, you know, artists versus Spotify, Spotify versus Apple. There's always this tension between people who have the content and people who have owned the rights to distribute the content. And this Substack is a great example of someone trying to change all that. So Substack was getting a lot of attention in recent months, largely because the media loves to write about itself. I have to say, they're always happy to go on about how great they are and how they need to be protected from these tech companies that are going to ruin their business models. But the Substack business model is basically giving content creators a chance to monetize their own content without the need for, you know, all the stuff that usually was the purview of the big distributors. Yeah. Now, the problem, I think, with Substack is that what's going to end up happening is people are going to get so big that they're not going to need Substack anymore. Because, yeah, again, they own the contents. What's Substack really bringing to the party here and taking 10% of? Revue, on the other hand, is actually really exciting because in Twitter's hands, you could recreate as kind of Substack environment. And Twitter is actually contributing something, which is, you know, the chance that you could share this content or generate audience on this huge platform, yeah, which is built on people, you know, transferring information to each other and talking about ideas with each other. And, you know, it's so simple. Things like Twitter has everyone's email. So if you want to subscribe, just push the subscribe button. It's as easy as following.
Yeah, yeah,
know,
yeah.
If you've got your credit card linked, you're instantly paying for a newsletter. And manage all those newsletters in one space. So you're not going from one to the other trying to find the unsubscribe button on every single subscription that you've paid for. And you think about how Apple have been able to do this. How many apps on your phone do you subscribe to that you don't really even think about? You just know that they're all there and you're enjoying them, and every now and again you get a message to say, hey, this subscription fee has come up, do you want to cancel this? And some of them you do and some of them you don't. Imagine how powerful that could be on, yeah, Twitter for all the content that you want to collect in your life, all the content that you care about. So I'm sure what Twitter's going to do is mess this up because that's what they always do. But, you know, there's a big difference between buying a great company and executing. Yeah. We all remember Vine,
yeah,
the original TikTok. So I really hope that they are moving fast. They're pushing this quickly. I've seen already that they're putting out beta for this thing as we speak. Okay. So at least they're moving fast on it. But I really think it could be a game changer for them, and it could tie into this whole subscription model as well and make Twitter a place that people are happy to go to and pay for to get the content that they want and speak about it with the kind of people that they want.
Yeah, being happy to go to Twitter. I won't hold my breath on that one yet.
No more doom scrolling.
Let's move on then and take a quick look at some of the things going on in my Wall Street at the moment. This week we have a brand new stock of the month pick. Rory, when I was talking to you about this yesterday, you said there was actually a very easy selection for you to make this month. Why was that?
It was easy because there was so much noise that I had no other option but to just step back entirely.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of way. Sometimes, I don't know if you get this, Anna, but sometimes when there's just so much stuff happening, you just go, okay, I can't deal with any of that right now. I just need to focus on one thing. And then it just became, yeah, quite simple. Went back to fundamentals.
Yeah, exactly.
So don't forget, if you want to hear more of Rory chatting about this company, the latest episode of the Stock of the Month podcast is coming to the My Wall Street app on Monday, February 8th. You won't find this podcast anywhere else, so if you're not yet a member of My Wall Street but want to listen in, you can start your free trial by just clicking on the link in the notes for today's show. Jargon Busters, guys. Emmett, the first question I'm going to throw over to you, and this comes in from Dara, who got in touch with us via the My Wall Street app. He asked if there's a right time of the day to buy stocks. So I've heard people say this before, that, you know, you should avoid the opening hour and the closing hour, or maybe Fridays as well. To your mind, for a long-term investor, I suppose, is there a right time of the day you should buy or sell stock?
Yeah, I describe to that point. I mean, insofar as that I usually avoid the top and tail of the week. So I avoid the market open and market close on a daily basis and on a weekly basis, you know. So, you know, for me, just true observation, and I'm sure there's big data that could actually substantiate or, you know, knock down this point, but the first 2 hours of the day are ones I avoid. So that's from 9:30 Eastern time to around maybe 10:30 or 11:30. Yeah. And then at the tail end of the day, and you know, so that's between 3 and 4 p.m. New York time. So I would avoid those hours. I almost always place a market order, because I decide when I want to buy a share and I go, and the liquidity is usually sufficiently large for me to just fulfill the order at the time where I've made that decision. Almost always. I'm not going to go into trading types now. So I generally don't place an order out of hours. So I wouldn't have an order queued. I wouldn't sit down and place an order on a Saturday or a Sunday or during, you know, holidays. Equally, I would try and avoid, you know, buying shares or selling shares before quarterly reporting, because there's another frenzied activity. So I generally, around events plus the top and tail of the week, market orders, middle of the week, middle of the day, you know, we are long-term investors. So we should just get in when the heat is not playing a role in that particular decision at that time.
Absolutely. Thanks for that. The next question also comes in via the My Wall Street app, and this is from Alistair. He asks about iRobot and specifically how it is managing to sell its products at a premium price still, despite there being many knockoff versions out there. To use GoPro, I suppose, as an example here, we saw that GoPro's early market leading position was eaten away over time by, you know, cheaper versions of the camera coming out. What is iRobot doing to avoid this? Emmett, I might throw that back to you again.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of iRobot, and I don't put it in the same basket as I would GoPro, and I'm a shareholder in iRobot, and I'm a big believer in its future. So I suppose I'll start in the most microscopic of analyses, which is the fact that I've been a customer of iRobot for probably 10 years, and it's that robot plays a large part in the functioning of our home, and it cleans the floor to a very high level, and each successive iRobot we've bought has been better than the last, and notably better, quieter, better tech, very impressive software and app and all that kind of stuff. So that's an opinion of one, and I haven't bought any of the cheap knockoffs, which I'm reliably informed are very, very good as well. But if I zoom out a little bit, and Wired magazine, or online Wired, there just about a week ago did a review of the best robot vacuums for any budget in 2021, and their review of the best robotic vacuum in 2021 is the iRobot Roomba i7 Plus, which is the one I have in my home here. So third-party reviewers have noticed that it is in fact more effective, you know, cleans the floor better, has better tech, better software. And then when we zoom out even further again, you know, there's so many parallels that we can draw between any piece of hardware and cheap knockoffs. So why would you buy an iPhone instead of an entry-level Huawei, for example? Or, and that's not even to diss Huawei, I'm just saying, like, why would you choose one piece of hardware over another? And generally, it's look, it's feel, it's usability, and it's software. And the look and feel, usability, and software of iRobot is really, really good. So if you want to buy a cleaning robot that kind of is top-end, and you're not absolutely budget-sensitive, then I believe iRobot is the one. And also, I suppose, just looking at the company performance, which is what we're here to do as investors, third quarter for iRobot sales were up 43% year over year, mostly driven by their higher end products, which are priced above $500. And while cheap robot vacuums are widely available, you know, from umpteen other manufacturers, consumers are willing to pay for a better piece of hardware. And frankly, despite the recent short squeeze, I think iRobot is cheap. It's a $3 billion business that has a brand name that's known across America. It's in, I don't know how many millions of homes. Last count was something like 20 million homes in the US. And it has a P like a utility company. So I actually think iRobot has a very promising long-term future ahead.
Okay, thanks for that. Last question for today then concerns Salesforce and its recent acquisition of Slack. As Slack is a company that features in both the My Wall Street shortlist and the Horizon portfolio, I'm interested to hear both of your guys' opinions on whether you're planning on holding onto your shares and becoming a shareholder of Salesforce through the acquisition, or are you going to offload your Slack shares and take the profit? Rory, I'll come to you first. What do you think of this?
So personally, I own shares of Slack, and I decided to sell them and redeploy them in another asset, which was Peloton.
Peloton.
Steve Sparks, yeah, Peloton. The thinking behind it was that, you know, when I bought Slack, I bought them for a particular purpose, and I had that in a part of my portfolio that I had thinking in terms of growth, and I thought it was going to be a great growth stock. Moving over to Salesforce, which I think is a brilliant company. I'm a huge fan of Mark Benioff and the business that he's built there. That just didn't sit in my portfolio in that way. And, you know, Salesforce with Slack now, I think, is a much more powerful business. I think it's going to experience some great growth in the years ahead. And it's one of those ones where I'm always like, why isn't it in our showroom? So maybe it will be in our showroom pretty soon, because I do think it's a great company. It wasn't the reason I didn't stick with it wasn't because of any, you know, that I didn't like the company or anything like that. It just didn't align with what that money had been originally intended for in, as part of that portfolio.
What do you think, Emmett? Would you agree that, you know, Slack was a growth stock, Salesforce maybe not so much a stock you would hope to see as much growth on?
I followed the exact same trajectory as Rory. I made the same decision. I was a shareholder. I sold for pretty much the exact same reason. I admire Salesforce massively. And as Rory said, I think it's a better company, or will be a better company, when Slack is integrated. And as I've said a few times recently, Salesforce was one of my kind of investment regrets. So I got out. I made 75% or thereabouts on the sale. And I could have as easily held and taken the cash and also converted over to shares at some point in the weeks ahead, and very happily being a CRM or Salesforce shareholder. I just, again, like Rory, just figured I have better places I want to deploy that capital. So snap.
Cool. Thanks for that. So let's move on to the elevator pitch then. So this week's elevator pitch, there's a lot to live up to, and we've decided to go with I think an equally spicy topic here. So guys, today what I want you to do is tell me what S&P 500 stock you would short if you had to. I'm going to come in with the disclaimer here that this is obviously a bit of fun. We would never recommend that long-term investors short stocks. Know the dangers. You can lose more than 100% of your investment, etc., etc. But if you had to short one S&P 500 stock, what would you pick? Rory, I'll go with you first.
I'll put the further disclaimer in here that this isn't the most well thought out pitch, because when I'm looking at stocks, like as soon as I see one thing I don't like, I just stop looking, you know. Yeah. I don't deep dive into why it's bad. I just go, nah, not for me. And then so there's no like real deep logic to this pick. However, the one I would do based on one thing alone is Cisco Systems. And the reason I would do that is because it's a $200 billion company who at one point had Eric Yuan, the CEO of Zoom, as an employee. He pitched a brilliant idea in the company, tried to lead the company in a totally new innovative direction. They rejected his idea and he left and took something like 80 engineers with him and founded Zoom, which is now going to overtake them as one of, I think, the biggest communication companies in the world. So just for that one just lack of foresight on their part, I think, you know, $200 billion, you let that slip through your fingers. Come on. I've also used their consume competitor recently, and trust me, there's a reason why Zoom has got the valuation it does.
I know exactly what you're talking about there. It's not a great product. Emmett, what about you?
Again, I have to emphasize caution here. While obviously my crystal ball was perfectly functioning for AMC, I am not a shorter of stocks, and I'm not one at predicting when a stock is going to fall. And the fact that it has to be an S&P 500 company kind of further restricts it. I did spot something outside the S&P 500, which I thought was a little bit richly valued, but I'm going to stay within the parameters. And I'm going to go with L Brands, ticker LB. Simply, again, just one data point. The L Brands are better known for Victoria's Secret, or is it Secrets? What is it, Rory? Victoria's Secret or Victoria's Secrets?
How many secrets does she
have? Don't drag me into this.
But anyway, L Brands, owner of Victoria's Secret, has been on a run lately. And the reason I would short it, it's like an awful lot of stocks over the last couple of months has doubled in value. But it's swimming in debt. You know, the company has a market cap at the moment of around $12 billion. Its enterprise value, which is when you minus out cash and add in debt, is about nearly $19 billion. And it's traditional retail. I'm sure they figured out their online model, but I just think, you know, that the business looks to me to be a little bit richly valued for an old world business. But that, I mean, as you can see, the shorting thesis there is not very rock solid, but I'd short L Brands.
If L Brands stock starts dropping rapidly next week, I'm calling the SEC, Emmett, I'm telling you now. Or confiscating that crystal ball off you.
Didn't L Brands try to offload Victoria's Secrets at one point and they couldn't even sell it for like way less than what it's valued at now. That was recent.
Yeah,
enough,
it wasn't that long ago.
And by the way, just the other one I was thinking of, and this is not in the S&P 500, is even riskier, and there's no way I'd short it or L Brands or anything for that matter, is MicroStrategy, who are most, I suppose, famed recently for becoming really an investment in Bitcoin. And they've run from $100 a share to $650 a share. They've missed every quarterly earnings for the last long, long time. They keep missing their consensus analysts. So as a business, they're not performing. But effectively, when you buy shares of MicroStrategy, I think an awful lot of the excitement is down to the fact that they bought a whole pile of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I just don't see. I'd short MicroStrategy, but I wouldn't, if you know what I mean.
The stock is only up nearly fivefold in the last year, so... We'll wait to see how those play out. So that's it from this week's Stock Club. Don't forget about all the great new stuff in My Wall Street at the moment. If there's anything you'd like us to discuss or explain on the next episode, make sure to get in touch. You can find us on Twitter, that's at My Wall Street HQ, or email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. That's pod@mywallstreet.com. Don't forget to subscribe to Stock Club too. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a review or a rating for us on whatever podcasting platform you listen to us on. That's it from us here today. Stay safe and we'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Happy investing.